All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 070572, Gail Ashley versus Doris D. Hawkins from Montgomery County and the Ninth Court of Appeals District. Docket number 071031, City of DeSoto, Texas versus Justin White from Dallas County and the Fifth Court of Appeals District. And 071051, Galbraith Engineering Consultants, Inc. versus Sam Pachuca and Gene Pachuca from Bexar County and the Fourth Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument, and we should complete all of them well before noon. We will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments will be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 070572, Gail Ashley versus Doris D. Hawkins.
Court, Mr. Cooper will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
The court. Article 16.063 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, as interpreted by the Court of Appeals in this case, is unconstitutional. Now, this court is faced, I believe, with two choices. One is to go ahead and declare 16.063 as unconstitutional, or the second alternative is to reverse Vaughn versus Dietz so that 16.063 may be interpreted in a fashion that avoids its unconstitutional infirmities.
Well, what about number three, apply Curlin?
Well, glad you brought that up, Your Honor. Curlin, which this court decided a couple of months ago, took a sidestep around Vaughn versus Dietz. We had the dissent in Vaughn versus Dietz, who argued that the fact that a defendant has a statutory agent, either the Secretary of State or then the Commissioner of Motor Vehicles, operates to be as a presence in the state so that they're not absent from the state. That was rejected in Vaughn versus Dietz. This court, though, and Your Honor wrote the majority opinion, and Curlin said, well, we're not going to reverse Vaughn versus Dietz. However, we are going to say that if a defendant, in that case, Mr. Curlin, who continually received royalty payments periodically over a long period of time, is conducting business that would subject him to service under the long-arm statute, then he is present and he is not absent for the purposes of 16063.
Well, and the long-arm statute also says commits a tort in whole or in part, and why wouldn't an automobile accident apply?
I believe the commission of a tort would subject a defendant to service under the long-arm statute, but as I interpreted and read the majority of the opinion, it was the continued doing business, the continued receipt of the checks over a period of time that would subject the defendant to liability or service under the long-arm statute and would operate as a presence in the state of Texas. If the commission of a tort, a one-time tort, was basically to make the defendant present in the state of Texas, then I think the viability of Vaughn versus Dietz would be totally undone, and there would have been a reversal. But the majority, as I read in Curlin, seemed to be going to great lengths not to reverse Vaughn versus Dietz,
well,
but to make that distinction.
We relied on the language of the long-arm statute, and we said it really doesn't matter for presence whether somebody has been appointed an agent for service, but we said the long-arm statute defines presence, and it defines presence as a contract or a tort. So it would seem to fit the literal wording of the long-arm statute.
Well, as I read the facts in this case, the court was focusing on the fact that Mr. Curlin continued to receive royalty payments allegedly that belonged to someone over a period of time, and that it was this receipt of these royalty payments over the period of time that operated as a presence.
So, let me just say, it's your view that doesn't apply?
The way I interpret the majority opinion, because it seems like to me, Your Honor, that if we're saying a one-time event, a one-time a tort would make the defendant present for all times within the state, then the Vaughn versus Deitch really would have no applicability. And the way I read the concurring opinion in Vaughn versus Deitch, in Curlin was that they were arguing for the presence, that is, the fact that you had a statutory agent meant that you were present in the state and subject to service, and therefore you were not absent for the purposes of 16.063, was the way that I read it. Now, if the court, obviously you wrote the opinion, and you know it probably better than I or anyone in here, is intended for Curlin to mean that a one-time foray through Texas by a non-resident, and you have a motor vehicle accident, and that operates to for the next 10, the next 20 years, make you present in the state. If we indulge in that interpretation, as far as the long arm statute, former 2131B and 17.044, then that would cure, I believe, the constitutional infirmities that exist with respect to 17.063. But, and I don't see from looking at Curlin that there is a whole lot of disagreement that 17.063 under the Commerce Code clause has problems. It was created at a time when we didn't have long-arm statutes, we didn't have substituted service, we didn't have Rule 106, 108, and it's the concerns that the legislature had back in 1841 when it was originally passed certainly are not present here today. And as the U.S. Supreme Court in the Bendix case certainly noted, when you apply the PAC balancing test, the interest of the state in protecting the creditors really is not that great, because the creditors in Texas are protected. There are multiple methods of service by which they can affect service on someone who has left the state. And then you balance that against the burden on interstate commerce, and that is someone who moves to California could be subjected to a lawsuit 10, 20, or even 30 years later down the road, certainly is a burden on interstate commerce. We are dealing with a federal statute. We also know what at least the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals feels regarding 16.063. I understand that the Cato's opinion has been withdrawn and the decision referred back to Judge Lynn in Dallas for reconsideration in light of this court's decision in Curlin. But we certainly know that absent some relief from Curlin, that the federal courts, and again, this is a federal constitutional provision that we're dealing with, believe that it is 16.063 is constitutionally infirm, and that it would violate the dormant clause of Article 1, Section 8 of the federal Constitution. And so it seems to me that we're here now, and again, we may have three choices. One is we can declare 16.063 as unconstitutional if we're going to apply it as the Court of Appeals did in this case, and where they say if you are out of the state, an out-of-state resident, then the statute is told for however long, be it 10, be it 20, be it 30 years, then it is constitutionally infirm. In fact, that was sort of the situation that existed in the Cadles case, where there had been a guarantee signed, I believe, between 1985 to 1988, and the defendants, the guarantors, had been outside the state of Texas for some 15, 20 years, and the creditor was trying to assert that the statute of limitations had never run on those guarantees for some 18 or 20 years, even though the guarantors in those cases were subject to service by the Secretary of State or through some substituted means under Rule 106 or 108. So, one, we can declare it unconstitutional. Two, I believe, is reversing Vaughn versus Dietz. And I think if 16.063 was construed to hold that if there was a statutory agent, be it the Secretary of State or in this case the chairman of the Department of Public Safety, who is the agent for non-resident motor vehiclists who commit torts in Texas, that also, I believe, would be an interpretation which would render 16.063 not unconstitutional. And again, Judge O'Neill, as you've pointed out, depending upon how Curlin is interpreted, the way I read it, I did not see where Ms. Ashley would fit within, because she was here and she did not have the continual contact as Mr. Curlin did over the period of time, which to me seemed to be the focus that the court had in the Curlin case. If Curlin were extended to include a one-time event, a one-time contact, then I agree that would also be a third alternative by which the 16.063 could be interpreted to remove the constitutional infirmities that I believe everybody here in this room feel exist with respect to 16.063. I will give the court back some of its time. We would ask the court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and to reinstitute the judgment that the trial court had entered in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. The court will hear argument now from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Manley will present argument for the respondent. Mr. Kraft will present argument for the state of Texas.
May it please
Mr. Manley will
open court
with the first 15 minutes.
Thank you. May it please this honorable court. It is undisputed that motor vehicle accident occurred on May the 31st, 2003. That a lawsuit was filed by the respondent, Doris Hawkins, on April the 1st, 2005. It is undisputed that the defendant, Gail Ashley, left the state of Texas in 2004. That she left without leaving a forwarding address. She left the state of Texas without changing the address on her Texas driver's license. She left the state of Texas without changing her voter registration card. She did not make any effort that a reasonable person would have made if they're leaving their estate, moving somewhere else, to put somebody on notice where they would be. It's also, I believe, based on the record that this petitioner did not rebut the statute in terms of showing that it was not applicable to the facts of this case.
But
the courts
also
have held.
Excuse me. It's also undisputed, isn't it, that by having operating a vehicle in the state of Texas, that Ashley was amenable to process under the long arm statute.
Your Honor, I was going to address that. Yes, I think that Gail Ashley was not amenable to service under the long-arm statute, and that's the statute pertains to motor vehicle accident statute 17.062, the Civil Practice Remedy Code. In order to utilize that statute and make that person amenable, you have to furnish a current address or a verifiable address to the chairman of the Transportation Commission. If you're not able, if you just make up any address, there's not going to be good service. If you don't furnish an address that the chairman can forward and give notice to that person, then you have defective service, Your Honor. Well, the statute goes on to say that fails service.
So the plaintiff controls over whether the defendant is amenable to process?
Sir?
The plaintiff controls then over whether the defendant is amenable to process?
The plaintiff does not have the power to get secure service of process where the whereabouts of the tortfeasor is unknown. Mm-hmm. There's no power whatsoever. If you send a certified copy of the petition to the chairman of the Texas Highway Commission, you don't furnish a good address, that's going to come back to you. That's failed service under Article 17065, which says then the plaintiff may personally serve the defendant.
Well, what's wrong with the address on the driver's license?
Your Honor, it was 15. It was the address that was on the police report. That was on the we. Let me just back up.
I assume that's the one plaintiff's attorneys always use.
No, that's not the way I operate. I always try to verify a current address by checking the driver's license, and then if it usually matches up with the accident report, you know.
And
if it doesn't match up, then we try to verify it another means.
So you're not arguing that there was something wrong with your service in this case, that you've never served her because you gave them an improper address, are you?
No, Your Honor.
Because if your argument's right, then you still haven't served her today.
No. Let me just back up and say that suit was filed, service was immediately requested to the district clerk under certified mail. The district clerk of Montgomery County attempted service on three different occasions, came back unclaimed. Well, as other courts have held, if it comes back unclaimed, that means the person's not there. So then we start all the investigative techniques that we employed based on the affidavit was filed with the response to summary judgment. And
well, but we've held that your service is accomplished when you serve the transportation chairman. It's not when the person gets it. And if the name of the case escapes me, Campus Investments case, if it's their fault that the public address is no good, then we're not going to let them come in and say, oh, they didn't forward it to me at the right address, which I misled them about. I mean, if the person in a car wreck gives a false address to the police department, that's not your fault. And service on the transportation secretary, that does it, doesn't it?
Your Honor, due respect, that does not, because that's failed service under the statute. Then the statute specifically says that the non-resident, statute specifically says, if the non-resident refuses to accept delivery of the notice or is not able to get delivery, then the statute goes on to say that the plaintiff can personally serve the defendant. Let me point out that we asked for citation by mail. It failed. We then traced the defendant to what we thought was state of California. Within 30 days of that initial citation, Your Honor, we again asked a citation to be issued by certified mail. That was refused. Then we continue to try to locate this lady.
We don't have the question in front of us. If you were diligent, then 16064 doesn't matter.
Well, the courts have...
The question here, or 16063, the question here is, let's assume for a moment you weren't diligent. If you were diligent, it extends it until you get them served. But the question here is, assuming you weren't diligent, is it told by 16063?
Yes, sir. I mean, this court or any other court in the state has never held that you must show diligence to interpose 16.063 of the Civil Practice and Remedy Code. The cases I've read have actually said that you don't have to show any type of diligence, although I would argue, this honorable court, that the plaintiff exercised due diligence. We That was point two of our...
But the argument the other side, Mr. Cooper, is making, if you have two drivers, let's say it's a three-car accident, and one defendant lives in California and one lives in Dallas, and we wait 10 years, and we sue them under 16063, it's too late for the person in Dallas, but it's okay to sue the person in California. And the argument is, under the Bendix case, that's unconstitutional because you're telling everybody outside Texas, if you want the benefit of our limitation statute, you've got to live here. That's a constitutional problem, according to Bendix, and that's the issue he's raising. Now, why isn't that right?
Well, Your Honor,
We couldn't have a statute that says people in Texas have a 4-year limitations for breach of contract, but people in New York, those scheming people, have a 20-year statute of limitations. I mean, that's what the Constitution was all about, because states did that all the time before we got a Constitution, and so we put some stuff in there that said, look, you can't discriminate against New Yorkers just because you don't like them. Right? That would be unconstitutional.
Well, that's not what happened in this case.
The question is, 16063 operate that way? If you live in Dallas, you get a 2-year limitations, but if you live in California, you get a 3, 4, 5, or 20-year limitations period.
Well, I can see what the court's concern is, but we didn't, in this case, Your Honor, take that position. We went ahead and tried to diligently locate the defendant. Unfortunately, this defendant was not amenable to service, not by certified mail. She became amenable when we got lucky and a sheriff in Sacramento County. We tried to get her served at apartment 3 at an address in Loma Linda, California. He finally found the lady in apartment 23 in Loma Linda. So we got lucky. We were continuously not totally relying on this statute, okay? We were, diligently trying to find this lady. True, we want to fall back on the statute for protection because the statute, is a suspension statute. It suspends a tolling statute. But this case, from lawsuit to service, is less than a year, about 11 months. I don't know what else we could have heard. In the brief before the Court of Appeals, the defendant says that a simple Google would have been able to locate this defendant. I submit to the court that if a simple Google could locate a defendant, law enforcement would serve criminal warrants a lot faster. The United States government wouldn't have spent billions of dollars in 7 years trying to find Osama bin Laden. A simple Google is not the answer. I don't know if the court wants to tell us what we need to do step by step, but at least 3 or 4 AS citations, continuously trying to find it through all the investigative tools, and I was a private investigator for 15 years. So I'm familiar. We have sources available to locate people. If a person decides for whatever reason to not make themselves amenable for service, it's like hunting for a needle in a haystack.
You're here on a summary judgment. They moved for summary judgment saying limitations barred.
That's correct.
And didn't they include in that you hadn't an argument, their argument that you hadn't been diligent?
They raised that.
And you responded with what?
I responded with the fact, Your Honor, the trial court. We paid 16.063, responded with argument we were diligent, attached to affidavit that never was challenged at the trial court level.
Right, but were there gaps in that affidavit?
Not in my opinion, Your Honor. There weren't gaps.
The trial judge's opinion, apparently,
there were. Well, I didn't.
So why is a matter of law the trial judge are wrong, or that there's at least a fact question, and did you in fact make sure there were no gaps?
Yes, we believe, because we pointed out in our summary judgment response that we continuously tried to locate this defendant, and that from start to finally when she was served, which was 11 months later, we were still trying to locate her. So there weren't any gaps, but I mean, by the fact that citation was initially requested, we didn't wait 4 months to request citation. Immediately requested, failed service, 30 days later, requested another citation where we thought she was in California, failed service. We continued, but Judge...
Let me ask you, if we decided and agreed with you that you exercised due diligence in attempting service, would we still reach 16063 or not?
I don't think you would, Your Honor. I don't think you would. This court and other courts have never held the requirement that you should exercise due diligence. I don't have a problem with that. Obviously, I'd like to have the protection of that statute so there's no, because as a matter of law, I think we created a fact issue that should have gone to the jury on diligence. We weren't allowed to prosecute this case. My client was waiting for a day in court. So I think if the court found that due diligence was exercised, that satisfies our needs. I think I have 1.56 minutes left. I'll save the court some time.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. The court will hear argument from the state of Texas.
Please, the court. Justice O'Neill, it's unclear to me why Mr. Cooper says Kirtland doesn't apply to this case. It clearly does. A one-time commission of a tort is defined as doing business in the state under the long-arm statute, and therefore Kirtland would apply in this case. Now, Kirtland said that a person is present for purposes of the tolling statute if they are amenable to service and subject to jurisdiction in the state. Clearly, under the long-arm statute, this commission of a tort rendered Ashley subject to the jurisdiction of Texas even after she moved to California.
PHC Minden says the relevant time period is when you file suit, not something that happens before, and I guess a reasonable time before that. Certainly, if people come here and do a tort, you need a reasonable time thereafter to file suit. But that, if you do a tort once, just passing through the state, that wouldn't last forever that you're doing business in the state, would it?
It would mean you were subject to specific jurisdiction in the state during the period of limitations, which is the relevant time period. And so the question really is, was she amenable to service? And this court has not said what that means. I think this goes to your question, Justice Green. Does the plaintiff control it, or to what extent does the plaintiff control it? States have done different things on this. Some simply say if the person could have been served, they're amenable to service. Justice Brister, some states have read a diligence requirement into it. The person could have been served in the exercise of reasonable diligence. That's something that this court may have to decide in this case. And here I should point out one of the things the Solicitor General's office is doing is preparing a 50-state survey that will outline what all the states do as to these tolling statutes, whether they have been judicially limited, as this court did in Kirtland, and whether there's a diligence component, and whether there are constitutional challenges. So the first...
Are you going to share that survey with the court?
Yes, we are going to share that with you. We'll be filing that as soon as we can. But that's the first question in this case. The first option is not... Is the statute unconstitutional? That's never the first option. The first question is, does the tolling statute even apply under Kirtland? If the court determines that it doesn't apply, then the constitutionality of the statute is not implicated, and indeed, she doesn't even have standing to challenge it.
You'd agree. My hypothetical, Texas couldn't pass a one statute of limitations for residents and a longer one for non-residents.
That's correct, under Bendix. But the reason why he's not right about Bendix now is Kirtland. Kirtland fixed the Bendix problem because now we're not imposing...
Same limitation for everybody.
That's right. This person who is in California who got in the car accident would be subject to jurisdiction and amenable to service. And so that doesn't impose any burden on them. They don't have to stay in Texas. They don't have to appoint an agent. So there's no longer a constitutional problem, and indeed every court that has looked at a statute that has been limited the way that our statute has now been limited in Kirtland has said there's no Commerce Clause problem. And we cite those cases on page 4 of our latest brief. There's another one I didn't mention in there, Hunt versus Enzo Biochem at 471 F sub 2nd 390. It's out of the Southern District of New York from 2006. There it rejected a Commerce Clause challenge to tolling statutes from California, Florida, Massachusetts, and South Carolina because all of those tolling statutes had been limited in the same way that we limited ours in Kerlin. And what happened in the Fifth Circuit, they did issue an opinion saying that our tolling statute was unconstitutional as applied to non-residents, but that was pre-Kerlin. And we raised these same cases in the Fifth Circuit, and they said those cases may be correct, but the Texas statute is not narrowly drawn to apply only when someone is not amenable to service.
Because of Vaughn
and other cases had never limited. But then after Kerlin was issued, we filed a petition for panel rehearing saying now the Texas statute is narrowly drawn. The Fifth Circuit, in response, granted that petition for panel rehearing, withdrew the opinion saying that the statute is unconstitutional, and sent it back to the district court for reconsideration in light of Kerlin. So Kerlin resolves this constitutional issue, and if the statute does apply to her, it's not going to present a problem under Bendix.
So this resolution leaves Vaughn undisturbed, in your opinion?
Vaughn has been effectively overruled because it's been so cabined in by Kerlin that it's not going to come up anymore, because I can't foresee a case where someone would be subject to substituted service through the transportation commissioner, thereby implicating Vaughn, and yet not amenable to service and present in the state under the long-arm statute under Kerlin. So I don't think Vaughn is ever going to come up again.
Well, and the problem about someone passing through and committing a tort, as I read Kerlin, we did say it's got to comport with federal due process concerns.
Yes.
And that situation might not.
It might not. I'm not aware that that's been challenged, though. As if you were subject to jurisdiction during the period of limitations, that would be the relevant time for you.
Further questions? Thank you.
Let's address Kerlin first. Kerlin, right before the paragraph before the conclusion, the majority says, in this case, the jury found that Kerlin was receiving royalty payments that rightfully belonged to the Bollies from January 1, 1966 through February 8, 1991. Suit was filed in Kerlin February 1993. So what, Judge O'Neill, I read your opinion saying is from 1966 through 1991, they were receiving these monthly payments, and that was presence within the state that would bar the statute of limitation because...
But that's not what we said in the paragraph before, but if you want to...
No, I'm just trying to interpret what the court was saying, and also, and we'll see what Judge Lynn does in the Cato's case, but in the Cato's case, it is more like our case because there were guarantees signed by the Goldners between 1985 and 1988. They moved out of Texas in 1988, and then there was no further contacts with the Goldners with the Texas until they were sued, I believe, 2004, 2005, something along those lines. There was no other contacts which would, again, as some read the Kerlin case, have subject them to presence and liability, not liability, but jurisdiction under the long-arm statute. And so I think there is a distinction between the Kerlin case because of all those contacts.
Well, but those contacts stopped 2 years before the suit was filed.
Correct. And it was those contacts, though, that, and again, I don't want to put words in Judge O'Neill's mouth. She's certainly capable of speaking for herself.
No doubt.
No doubt. Okay. But it seemed to me that it was the continual, the fact that every month there was a royalty check that was allegedly fraudulently being taken that established a presence in Texas that prevented 16.063 from...
So one royalty check may not have done it. One accident may not have done it.
Well, you were present when you received the royalty check back in 1966. But the question is, if you received a royalty check in 1966, would that make you present from 1966 up until 1991?
Mm-hmm. Was the plaintiff diligent?
We don't believe they were in this case, Your Honor. We believe there were gaps. If you look at the record, you'll show that, for example, there was a citation attempted in 52705. There was no new citation issued or attempted until March 17th of 06. On October 11th of 05, in the motion to retain, this case was dismissed from the docket, I believe, once, and was set for dismissal at least twice.
So 10-month unexplained gap?
Well, I think there's maybe 7 or 8 months. In this court, in the Gant case, has said as few as 3.5 months is not long enough. The other issue is, as far as due diligence, if you have an agent within the state of Texas, someone has appointed CT Corporation. Judge Brister, you have. But I'm intent on trying to serve you personally. You've got an agent in downtown Austin that I can serve, but I'm trying to find you in your Colorado home or wherever to serve you. Now, the question is that due diligence if the person has an agent that I could go across the street and serve the entire time period? So we don't believe that there was due diligence. We believe the trial court was correct in its holding, and we would ask this court to affirm the judgment of the trial court.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.